Hello, I am Dave Emery, and this is For the Record, program number 1123. The past is prologue, further reflections on the COVID-19 outbreak and the genesis of the medical-military complex. This is being recorded live on the 20th of March of 2020. I thought that with all of the discussion of biological warfare and with media battling between China and the U.S. over the COVID-19 outbreak, again, occurring in the context of a very obvious destabilization effort against China, masterminded by Steve Bannon, whose primary philosophical slash political reference point is Julius Evola, an Italian-born fascist who moved from Mussolini, his original political affiliation. He concluded Mussolini was a bit on the moderate side and eventually experienced something of a gain of function, metamorphosis, so to speak, to the Nazi SS, who were financing his effort by the end of World War II. I thought it was interesting in the Pepe Escobar article from the Asia Times that, at least according to Mr. Escobar, the CIA was involved with the Event 201 dress rehearsal, or pandemic dress rehearsal in the U.S., which began on the same day as the World Military Games, a military athletic contest in Wuhan, which, again, I speculated that perhaps, and this is obviously perhaps, if someone wished to introduce the COVID-19 or one of its variants, the more mild variant, could have been vectored by, say, elements of CIA or some other malefactor into the military, U.S. military contingent, who, being in tip-top shape and with strong immune systems, might not have been symptomatic at all or very mildly ill, and as envisioned perhaps by that element of CIA or other malefactor, would have vectored it to other military athletes who also would have been in tip-top shape and perhaps even asymptomatic, or if one infected by the milder strain or one of the milder strains of COVID-19, would have been either asymptomatic or very mildly ill, and that could have spread it around the world. There is still a great deal we are not being told of exactly how many people in this country are infected, I think, is up for grabs. As far as what we have been told, the reaction appears to be a gross overreaction. But then there may be many, many more people infected than we have been told. Who knows? I've ruminated about that. The shutting down of Fort Detrick in August of last year by the CDC is something I think that warrants examination in that regard. We are going to be taking a look at, as indicated in the title of the program, the part of the genesis of the military medical complex. We're going to be going back to something. And as I contemplate the lies and what the brilliant political comedian Mort Saul observed correctly, how many lies before you belong to the lie. Mort Saul, by the way, one of Jim Garrison's co-investigators, so to speak, in his investigation of the JFK assassination. When you don't take care of business in Dallas, then, well, all the rest follows. And we're going to be going back in history, and we're going to be going back to into the archives, I think, to 1985 or perhaps 1986. I will have that in the description. This is Miscellaneous Archive Show M 31. The Killing of Corporal Coons, Leon Jaworski's first cover-up. And again, we're going back to the mid-80s, and we're going to be taking a look at Leon Jaworski and his exercise of, quote, judicial restraint, unquote, when he was Colonel Leon Jaworski of the Judge Advocate General's office and declined to prosecute American military officers who were allowing their pro-Nazi POW cohorts in, at an Oklahoma prison camp to police the mail and basically to continue to supervise or command the POWs in that camp. And one of them, a Wehrmacht colonel named Corporal Coons, was very critical of the Third Reich, and he was murdered by the inmates there who were allowed to screen his mail. And although the inmates ultimately were subjected to military discipline by Jaworski et al., ultimately Jaworski exercised, quote, judicial restraint and did not have the officers prosecuted. That became something of a pattern for Leon Jaworski, and after listening to this excerpt of the archives, we are going to take a look at how Jaworski's continued exercise of judicial restraint is at one with the incorporation of some of the cream of the Third Reich's war criminal medical establishment into our own medical military complex. So here is an excerpt from Miscellaneous Archive Show M31. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my charming and brilliant former co-host, Nip Tuck. And again, this is from the mid-1980s. So we're going back roughly 35 years into the archives.
As an architectural consultant to Hawaii, again, he was not exactly picking his teeth with a bayonet and dodging Spitfires at every turn. I mean, the lead paragraph there makes the whole thing sound just a little more intense than it was.
It's quite a bit different than those guys they talk about that they find out in, you know, Mindanao or Okinawa who've been hiding up in the bushes for 40 years eating rabbits. You know, it's not quite the same thing.
Any bushes he's been hiding behind might have a capital B, and if that sounds like we're stretching a point, the reason why we brought up that perhaps arcane-seeming article to some of you was that the rather lenient treatment that he's received, certainly he's done fairly well for himself for a fugitive from justice, and one of the things that we're asking ourselves here is whether his relatively decent fortunes were due to the fact that the effort to get him was less than enthusiastic. We bring that up because basically, returning once again to the closing years of World War II, which is a period we focus on so often, as we said a few minutes ago, the residual elements of the Third Reich, which were considered either more useful or more palatable than Hitler and some of his closest associates, were incorporated into not only the West German government after World War II, but also into our own intelligence system and defense department, as we looked at in our last Radio Free America broadcast, and in general were forged into just the sort of broad-based anti-Soviet alliance which elements on both sides of the Atlantic were looking to form during the closing years of World War II. Now, by way of building what at the time was considered to be an anti-communist bulwark across Europe, those Germans who were of pro-Hitler and consequently anti-communist sentiment were accorded relatively lenient treatment by the U.S. authorities as well as the British and elements of the French following World War II. Specifically, anti-Hitler POWs in the United States were allowed, were not only discouraged from normal political expression, but specifically the pro-Hitler elements within the German prisoner of war camps in the United States, in other words, camps for German POWs, they were basically run by pro-Hitler elements. The American authorities allowed the Nazis to run these camps, and during the closing years of World War II, actually, those Germans who, or many Germans who expressed pro-Hitler sentiments were murdered and otherwise disciplined.
And anti-Hitler sentiments.
We expressed anti-Hitler sentiments, I mean, because the pro-Hitler forces were running these camps, at the discretion of the American forces. And in addition, as we're going to see here in just a second, many of the pro-Hitler Germans were allowed conjugal visits from their wives so that their children, being born in the United States, would be American citizens from birth. This, again, to be seen in the context of the importation of the Galen Organization and thousands of SS and Gestapo men, as well as the Project Paperclip scientists, both of which we've spoken about on programs in the past, our Radio Free America and Guns of November shows. Now, of the extraordinary treatment accorded German POWs in this country during the closing years of World War II, and again, seeing this against the background of the incorporation of the residual elements of Nazism into a broad-based coalition immediately after World War II, we're going to take a look at a book called The Nazis Go Underground. We've looked at the book before. The book was authored by Kurt Reiss, R-I-E-S-S. And Reiss basically was an anti-fascist and espionage author who whose work was eclipsed during the McCarthy period. And of the, The Nazis Go Underground was published in hardcover by Doubleday and Duran and Company and copyrighted 1944, first printing March of 1944. So we're going to sort of climb in the time machine here and go back to 3 months before D-Day, 3 months before the Normandy invasion. Kurt Reiss writes in The Nazis Go Underground, "The United States, in an overgenerous interpretation of the Geneva Convention for Prisoners of War, has allowed these people to run their prison camps as a Nazi state within our country. They may hail Hitler, may refuse to have anything to do with non-Aryans, Jews or American Negroes, may arrange entertainments which mock the institutions and the leading personalities of the democracies, and they may even punish those of their own number who either have been always anti-Nazi or have come to doubt the value of the Hitler religion. This state of affairs would not be so bad if, after the war, these men and women could be deported to Germany. But there is little chance of this outwardly at least, since, outwardly at least, Germany will then become strictly anti-Nazi, and the men who will be running the German government will have to make a real show of their anti-Nazi conviction by putting all confirmed Nazis into a concentration camp. This gives the prisoners interned here the right to appeal against being sent back to Germany, and the United States, being a humane country, will probably let them stay. But many of these Nazis are not taking any chances. They are thorough. It is a fact, though it has never been published, that many of the internees find ways and means to meet their wives and have intercourse with them. The reason for this procedure, which incidentally is strictly against the law, is that a child may thus be produced, a child which, having been born on American soil, cannot be deprived of its American citizenship. And parents of such an American citizen are very difficult to deport. All of which means that we can be quite certain of having these dangerous enemy aliens, unquote, with us after the war. And that is what the coming Nazi underground is counting on." Now, we're going to take a look at specifically one of the aspects of the disturbing situation described by Kurt Reiss in Nazis Go Underground, namely the manner in which the pro-Hitler elements in POW camps in the United States were allowed to discipline, punish, and at times murder those anti-Hitler elements that were discovered in their midst. In order to take a look at this, we're going to go back to another book published during World War II, during the closing months. This is The Plot Against the Peace, co-authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn, K-A-H-N, published in hardcover by the Dial Press, copyright March of 1945, so 1 year later than The Nazis Go Underground. March of 44, now we're going to jump in the time machine and go ahead 1 year to about 3 months, 4 months actually, before the war ends in Europe. Describing now the FEMA, which were the secret underground murder gangs of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr, which dispatched the real or potential enemies of Nazism prior to Hitler's ascent before World War II. Basically, FEMIC units were formed in the German POW camps in the United States and proceeded to weed out anti-Hitler or potential anti-Hitler elements within the prisoner of war camps in the United States, as just indicated in the passage Kurt Reiss talked about. Now, specifically here, we're going to talk about how the Germans were able to weed out the political dissidents in their midst, the Nazis, that is, in American POW camps. Sayers and Kahn write in The Plot Against the Peace, in a section called The FEMA in America, "In January of 1945, the United States War Department made public some of the facts concerning the reign of terror which German army officers and Gestapo agents had instituted in German war prison camps in America. In 1943, within a few months after the thousands of German prisoners taken by the American Army in North Africa began streaming into the United States, the official War Department report disclosed that small groups of fanatical officers began to impose themselves as dominating factors on the German prison camp committees. in many camps, these men elected their own choices as camp spokesmen, unquote. Figureheads were chosen while the ringleaders remained in the background in order to conceal their identity from the American authorities. Propaganda was circulated that it was the duty of the prisoners to remain pure Germans, unquote, and to return to Germany after the war to carry out the work of the Nazi cause. All those suspected of anti-Nazism or distaste for German militarism were subject to intimidation and terror. Beatings of anti-Nazi prisoners were frequent. A series of violent deaths finally exposed the systematic character of this terrorism. The New York Times reported on January 16, 1945 that, quote, six murders and two forced suicides have occurred in German prisoner of war camps in the United States, and investigations by the War Department have indicated that in all but one of those eight cases, the victims were anti-Nazis who had been accused of treason by fellow prisoners. Some were charged with giving information to the American authorities, others with speaking or writing anti-Nazi views. Now, still later, Sayers and Kahn to go on to describe a specific murder of a German prisoner of war in the United States. At Camp Tonkawa, T-O-N-K-A-W-A, Oklahoma, on November 4th, 1943, the FEMA unit murdered Corporal Johann S. Kunz, K-U-N-Z-E, of Leipzig. Kunz was beaten to death. After the murder, a meeting was called in the mess hall. A German officer said that Kunz had been accused of high treason, unquote, in transmitting information to the American camp authorities. The German officer stated that the killing had been done in self-defense, unquote, and that it would be reported later to a German military court. Well, now note that Corporal Kunz was murdered because the Germans accused him of high treason by communicating information to American authorities. We're going to touch on the Kunz case here. We're obviously not going to have the time to go over most of it. In a nutshell, Corporal Kunz was murdered by fellow inmates who accused him of communicating damaging information to the American authorities. Now, in the investigation of the Kunz case, it came across that the pro-Hitler officers, the pro-Hitler inmates in these POW camps, had learned about Kunz. Kunz basically was less than thrilled with Hitler. He was drafted into the German army at the age of 38, and in letters to his wife, expressed some things about the sad state of Hamburg during the war and the effects of Allied bombings on Hamburg, and also expressed, which he had been through apparently at some point with his unit, also expressed a desire perhaps to settle in the United States with his wife after the war because specifically they wanted to get away from Germany and Nazism. So Kunz, because of the anti-Nazi views that were in some of the letters to his wife, was murdered by his fellow inmates. The subsequent investigation into the murder of Corporal Kunz centered on these letters and how the German inmates were able to get access to the letters and thus learn of Kunz's anti-Nazi sentiments. Of course, they accused him of communicating this information directly to the American authorities. And again, the information was gleaned from letters from Kunz to his wife, and the whole investigation about the killing of Corporal Kunz centered on where he got those letters. Now, ultimately, five Germans who had been prisoners of war at the Tonkawa camp were executed for the murder of Corporal Kunz. Nobody else, just five former POWs. So remember the ultimate disposition of the case and the key piece of evidence being how the letters came into possession of the pro-Hitler inmates of the Tonkawa camp.
Okay, and this book we're going to be reading a short bit from is called The Killing of Corporal Kunz. Again, as Dave said, spelled K-U-N-Z-E.
And the research credit for this connection here, this book, goes to Mae Russell, who turned us on to it.
Right. And the book is written by Wilma Parnell, P-A-R-N-E-L-L, with Robert Tabor. And it is published by Lyle Stewart, Incorporated, copyright 1981.
And Wilma Parnell, by the way, was the court reporter, the court stenographer, in the investigation of the murder of Corporal Kunz.
Okay. Now, they're talking about a man by the name of Rehberger being interrogated at this moment. Now, there's again, as Dave mentioned, that one of the subjects at hand is the most important subject is how did the Germans, who eventually wound up having Kunz killed, find out about these communications between himself and his wife? Okay, we'll explain some of these other things as we go along, too. So, again, reading from the killing of Corporal Kunz. It required a good deal more time, patience, and tears. But in the end, the unhappy prisoner, or medical soldier, as he preferred reluctantly admitted that, yes, Heisig, H-E-I-S-I-G, had told him about the notes and had said that they were obtained from Lieutenant Young, Okay, the notes they're referring to are the notes that that were used to implicate Kunz as far as the other Germans were concerned and led to his death. And this man, Rehberger, says that Heisig, who, as we will find out, is another German, had told him that the notes were obtained from a Lieutenant Young, Y-O-U-N-G, who is an American. It was discovered that Lieutenant Young was on leave. He would be back in a couple of days. Maffett, who's one of the investigators, sent for Feldwebel Karl Heisig. Heisig had penetrating dark eyes in an arresting manner that hinted at qualities beyond those of the ordinary Feldwebel. It was rumored at the time that the prisoner of war camps for enlisted men held a sprinkling of high-ranking Wehrmacht officers disguised as non-coms. And it crossed my mind, this is the author Wilma Parnell talking, and it crossed my mind that Heisig might well be one of them. Certainly he behaved as though he felt in complete command of his own interrogation. He admitted that he had given the, quote, spy notes to Hauptfeldwebel Beyer, B-E-Y-E-R, who's one of the guys eventually convicted. But he refused to say how or where he had obtained them. When Major Fuller appealed for his cooperation in the interest of a fair investigation, Heisig responded with equanimity, quote, sir, you can kill me. I will not say one word. I can understand how the boys felt. It's a crime to write things like that about one's country. Skipping down. You know where you got the note but won't tell us? They're asking Heisig. Yes, sir. Would your telling implicate someone else? Yes, sir. Then in that case, someone innocent may suffer. Isn't that so? I can't help it. I would rather suffer myself. Heisig, are you a member of the Nazi Party? Yes, sir. The questioning dragged on. Heisig yielded nothing. Did you get this note from an American? I cannot answer. I found it. Where? Anywhere. Now look here, Heisig, if you got it from an American, you aren't betraying your homeland by telling us so. I am an honest man. I never betray anyone. Heisig was dismissed. He saluted smartly, his expression inscrutable, but I thought there was a flicker of amusement in his brown eyes as he turned to leave. He marched sedately from the hearing room with more assurance than any of us felt at that moment. Skipping on down. Heisig was brought back after lunch for another sparring match. Nothing had changed. He refused point blank to identify the American lieutenant or anyone else as the source of the notes. Asked whether it would not have been natural for Rehberger to have inquired where Heisig had obtained the notes, Heisig calmly replied, "Yes, sir. Beyer asked me too, but I didn't tell." "Didn't you have enough confidence in Rehberger to tell him the whole story?" "I don't trust anyone, not even myself." "Are you keeping quiet to protect American or German personnel?" "I cannot answer. I am honest. Someday I want my family to know that I died an honorable man who loved his country." The officers called it a day. Immediately upon his return to camp, Lieutenant Young testified. He had none of Heisig's assurance. Responding slowly under the prompting of Major Fuller, he told the panel that the prisoner, Karl Heisig, inspected all mail sent out of the hospital by German patients and workers, and saw to it that letters were properly addressed, correctly folded, and packaged for the postal authorities. Heisig also functioned apparently as an unofficial censor, making sure that the letters contained no prohibited information. The adjutant said Heisig had the freedom of the entire hospital, confidential files accepted, and frequently went from one office to another in the performance of his duties. Young said that he was often away from his own office. Mail and other documents were sometimes placed on his desk by error, he said, and on such occasions it became his responsibility to feed them back into the proper channels. Skipping down, Major Fuller seized the first opportunity to interrupt him, waving away more elaborate explanations. Quote, "Lieutenant Young," he said, "I hand you this paper marked Exhibit A, the notes, and ask you to look at it carefully, read it, and state for the record whether or not you gave this document to Feldwebel Karl Heisig." Young, perspiring and flushed pink to the roots of his steel-gray hair, stared at the paper for a while and said flatly, "I have no knowledge of ever seeing this before." While not strictly responsive, the statement was clear enough. It was the last we were to hear from or of the lieutenant. He was whisked away to another assignment, and his name was never mentioned again in my presence. Astonishingly, Heisig, too, vanished at this juncture. He was transferred to another jurisdiction before he could be questioned again, and the trail of the document that had triggered the mess hall killing stopped with him. It had appeared one day in his hands, and he had handed it to Beyer. That was all we ever surely knew. Okay, before we go on, let me just point this out again, exactly what's going on here. Apparently, at some point, the document crossed Lieutenant Young, the American's, desk, and went into the hands of Carl Heisig, this medical soldier, as he calls himself, who was a German prisoner, essentially, and had a great deal of freedom within the operation of the prison camp to censor other prisoners' mail, to inspect their mail, and often having access to things in other people's offices. So at some point, not only was this particular bit of documentation important for the prosecution of a murder on American soil, but in fact it also was suggestive of an entire way of dealing with things in these prison camps that could have used some looking into. But in fact, as the author points out, not only the American lieutenant but the German were both whisked out of the jurisdiction of the investigation and were never questioned any more on the matter.
Now, right after this point in the testimony, which again, a obviously pro-Hitler German, a member of the Nazi Party, was allowed to censor all of the other inmates' mail as a result of the information which he admittedly communicated to the other Germans, a man was murdered. The American officer who allowed this kind of behavior is in no way involved in the investigation, and the trail stops. Eventually, five Germans were executed for the five German POWs for the murder of Kunz. But at this point, the prosecution basically was expanded. A person was brought in to oversee the course of the prosecution from this point, and this particular individual did not pursue either Officer Young or Heisig or the main connection in the case, which was why the Germans, the pro-Nazi Germans, were allowed basically to run these camps like they were their own little fiefdoms. And this special prosecutor is a person whose name we've come across in the past.
And interestingly enough, this involvement of this person we're going to be talking about was roughly coincident with the decision on the part of somebody in the United States Armed Forces to suddenly put the lid on this trial and make it secret. In other words, to ban the press and ban any kind of spectators or things of that nature. So what was basically a fairly simple matter of a murder in a prison camp became apparently enough of an embarrassment or a worry at some levels that it was made a secret trial. Anyway, reading again from the Parnell and Tabor book. At this point, Lieutenant Colonel Leon Jaworski of the Judge Advocate General's office in Dallas entered the case. I saw at once that I was nowhere near the finish line. For the moment, frustration engulfed me. I was sick of Blut und Geschlagen. Jaworski's quiet confidence was a quick restorative. All I knew of him at the time came from Fuller's description, quote, a crackin' good trial lawyer from Texas before he came to the Army, unquote. Skipping along. Although an interpreter was present at all times, the, quote, crackin' good trial lawyer from Texas, unquote, dealt with the witnesses directly, speaking a fluent German which he later told me he had picked up as a child. Skipping on. The judge advocate remarks on a prosecution, this is at the end of the trial, the judge advocate remarks on a prosecution, quote, brilliantly and masterfully conducted by Jaworski and Fuller, and also praises the prosecutors for their commendable restraint and for having been, quote, faithful to their responsibilities to produce all of the evidence irrespective of its effect, unquote. Well, as we saw, they certainly didn't produce much more evidence on Young and Heisig, since both of them were allowed to leave before the interrogations were finished and then moved out of the jurisdiction. Skipping on down. In his closing remarks, Jaworski says he has never before appeared in a court anywhere in which so much consideration was given to the facts of the case. Again, one has to wonder about that, if that's a slightly ironic statement, or if that's really true, what kind of cases was Jaworski involved in before? Quote, I am happy over it, he adds, because when this court writes its findings in this matter, it will come as the result of painstaking consideration of the evidence that has been presented, so that everyone knows, no matter who he is, no matter where he may be, that these accused have gotten the fair, impartial trial they are entitled to under the laws of this land. Well, interesting, and the commendable restraint that Leon Jaworski showed here, as we have talked about earlier in the show, crop up later on when, among other things, he's involved in Watergate, which, as Dave and I both suggested in our own personal opinions, perhaps was not prosecuted with quite the commendable lack of restraint that might have been necessary to have done something besides pardon Richard Nixon and cover the rest of the thing up.
In between his commendable restraint in prosecuting the Coons trial and Watergate, Jaworski went from the Coons trial, incidentally, to Nuremberg, and those who have listened to these shows for some time know about the commendable restraint that the Nuremberg prosecutors also used, since many of the defendants in those trials wound up working for our national security establishment. And after that, well, he then went to work for, among other things, an organization called the M.D. Anderson Fund, of which he was a member of the board of directors, which was a CIA domestic funding conduit. He then served as special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, investigating the JFK assassination for the state of Texas, also did the same thing for the Warren Commission, and specifically was in charge with seeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had any intelligence connections. Connections between, of course, the JFK assassination and Watergate, we talked about in Radio Era in Guns of November number 3. And following Watergate's special prosecutor, he then jumps ahead and becomes special prosecutor for the Koreagate scandal, in which the Unification Church and its role as a front for the Korean CIA and its role in that behalf in the United States were front and center. Now, jumping back once again to the Watergate hearings, did you want to say something? Oh, I thought I saw one of the a hand signal there. Research credit for this final item here, talking about Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski's commendable restraint. Reading now from Book 11 of the Hearings Before the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, that is the Watergate and Related Activities hearing. This is popularly known as the Watergate Committee. Reading now from Phase 2 of their hearings, from the hearings that were held on October 4th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 31st of 1973. This is from Book 11, and again, the research credit here goes to May Brussel. And from the Watergate transcripts, we find an interesting exchange here between Senator Talmadge of the Senate Watergate Committee and a Mr. Benz, B-E-N-Z, who was an employee of the so-called Dirty Tricks Unit of the Nixon White House employed by Donald Segretti. Talmadge says here, "I believe you two had subordinates. One was named Mr. Duke and the other was named Mr. Hearing. Is that right? Mr. Benz. His nickname was Duke. I do not believe that was his last name. Talmadge. One was named Duke and the other Hearing? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Did Mr. Hearing tell you that this man Duke was a former SS officer for Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Did you believe that? Benz. No, sir. Talmadge. Did Duke ever tell you that? Benz. I do not recall if he ever did or not. Talmadge. Did you feel that being trained by Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers particularly qualified him for the duties that you assigned him to? Benz. I do not know of any training school that would train him for this work. Talmadge. I could not hear you. Mr. Benz. I said I do not know of any training school that would train a person for this type of work. Talmadge. Were not the activities quite similar? Did not Hitler's Nazi stormtroopers perform similar activities to what you were engaged in Florida? Benz. I would not know that, Senator. Talmadge. You have read some history of that period, have you not? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Have you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, I take it? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Are not the activities of the Nazi stormtroopers somewhat similar? Benz. I do not recall if he ever did or not. That, of course, in the context that he replied. Talmadge. I thought they were. I read about a good many falsified documents during that era and libels and slander about the opposition. It was one of the ways, as I recall, that Adolf Hitler achieved power. Do you think Duke carried on his activities in an exemplary fashion in that manner, do you? Benz. Yes, sir. Talmadge. No further questions, Mr. Chairman. So again, that's from part of the Watergate hearings that you didn't hear publicly, that didn't look quite so neat on television. And of course, Watergate special prosecutor Leon Jaworski of the CIA showed a commendable restraint, as some might phrase it, in not taking up this as well as the many other aspects of the Watergate question that we've come across in the past. Recall that Nixon's Nazi connections were the subject of considerable discussion in Radio Free America show number 2.
And that was from Miscellaneous Archive Show number M31. The Killing of Corporal Coons, Leon Jaworski's First Exercise of Judicial Restraint, unquote. That, by the way, was recorded on September 25th of 1985. And, of course, my brilliant and charming former co-host Dick Tuck was the other voice you heard. Now, the aforementioned Leon Jaworski was one of those people who helped to midwife, I guess you could say, the contemporary genesis of the medical military complex, and that looms very large in the discussions we have engaged in vis-a-vis the COVID-19 in the context of a destabilization program against China, and the investing of people like J. Kyle Bass and others. We are going to take a look at the one of the relatively early parts of Leon Jaworski's career, and specifically one that took place shortly after he presided over the defendants in the killing of Corporal Coons. And again, he did not choose to pursue legal inquiry against or action against the American officers who permitted their Nazi equivalents in the POW camp to surveil, basically, and ultimately to murder Corporal Coons. By the way, you also heard in that excerpt from the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Reese. That is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Now, we're going to be taking a look at Leon Jaworski's role in the Texas Court of Inquiry. I guess, actually, we will start with that. You heard reference to Leon Jaworski, who, along with Judge Robert Story, capital S-T-O-R-E-Y, headed the Texas Court of Inquiry. That was the Texas state body that was in charge with investigating the assassination of JFK. Jaworski was also a Warren Commission counsel. He also, again, was on the board of the MD Anderson Fund, a documented CIA funding conduit. That, by the way, from Whitewash Volume 3 by Harold Weisberg. Maybe it was Volume 4, but by Harold Weisberg. In any event, it is in The Guns of November, Part 3 on the SpitfireList.com website. Now, again, along with Leon Jaworski, whom we will pursue in just a minute, the other member, the key member of the Texas Court of Inquiry, was Judge Robert Story, capital S-T-O-R-E-Y. Now, in an earlier professional incarnation, then Colonel Robert Story was instrumental in handing down the order to, quote, relax, unquote, the denazification edict at Nuremberg. Reading now from The Splendid Blond Beast, Money Law and Genocide in the 20th Century by Christopher Simpson. Both hard and soft cover editions, The Grove Press, copyright 1993. Colonel Robert Story, the U.S. Executive Trial Counsel at the International Military Tribunal and a senior aide to Robert Jackson, has, quote, passed the word down that the denazification directive was to be relaxed, unquote. Alfinger continued. Sympathetic U.S. officers promulgated this, quote, relaxation, unquote, largely by word of mouth during the summer of 1945, but this rumor network had considerable effect. The hardline U.S. officers targeted in Alfinger's, A-U-F-F-I-N-G-E-R's attack resigned before the year was out, despite the fact that it was their position in the denazification debate, not Alfinger's, that the President of the U.S. had publicly endorsed at Potsdam. Again, Colonel Robert Story, U.S. Executive Trial Counsel at the Nuremberg Trials, passed, quote, passed the word down that the denazification directive was to be relaxed, and relaxed it was. I would note that two of the principal members of the Warren Commission investigating, unquote, actually covering up JFK's assassination were Alan Dulles, who, as head of the Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS, was instrumental in the incorporation of the Galen organization into the fledgling CIA and ultimately helped to shepherd it into the as the intelligence service of the BND as well. John J. McCloy was also a key Warren Commission member. As U.S. High Commissioner for Germany, he saw to it that many heinous war criminals found a new career working for the U.S. We've spoken about the Nazi connections to the JFK assassination in many programs, The Guns of November, Part 4, AFA program number 15. We spoke about it in AFA program 37. We came back to it in AFA. We dealt with it also in AFA program number 11. For the record, programs numbers 876 and also number 971, among others. There are many others as well. I will put some of the links in the description for the record 1123. Now, for our purposes, bearing in mind Leon Jaworski's quote, judicial restraint in pursuing the killing of Corporal Coons, from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency of October 22nd of 1945 comes the following. Murders of thousands of Jews at Dachau will be tried by American military government, unquote. Colonel Leon Jaworski, who will be in charge of the trial, estimates that at least 5,000 Jews died at Dachau from ordinary mistreatment and torture, while anywhere between 1,000 and 3,000 died as a result of medical experiments performed upon them. The first of the defendants to be tried, he said, will be the doctors who conducted these experiments, most of whom are in custody. Jews who escaped death at Dachau will appear as witnesses. The trial will be held on the premises of the camp. Now, one of the things to note is that five of the doctors who had performed the medical atrocities at Dachau were already in the employ or had signed paperclip contracts with the U.S. This from Operation Paperclip by Annie Jacobson, the hardcover edition, Little Brown and Company, copyright 2014. The U.S. War Crimes Office for the Chief Counsel wrote up a list of doctors involved in medical research that resulted in, quote, mercy killing, unquote, a euphemism used by the Third Reich for its medical murder programs. The list was classified with a strict caveat that access to it would remain, unquote, restricted for 80 years from the date of creation, unquote. This meant that by the time the world would know who was on the list, it would be the year 2025 and everyone named would be dead. A copy of the list was given to the commander of the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center, Robert J. Benford. Five doctors working at the center, starting in the fall of 1945, were on the list. Theodore Benzinger, Siegfried Ruf, R-U-F-F, Conrad Schaefer, S-C-H-A-F-E-R, Hermann Becker Freising, F-R-E-Y-S-E-N-G, and Oscar Schroeder, S-C-H-R-O-D-E-R. Instead of firing these physicians suspected of heinous war crimes, the center kept the doctors in its employ, and the list was classified. Now, about each of these doctors, again reading from Operation Paperclip by Amy Jacobson. Dr. Oscar Schroeder, head of the Luftwaffe Medical Corps, was thrilled. Conrad Schaefer had, quote, developed a process which actually precipitated the salts from the seawater, unquote, Schroeder later testified. But another group of Luftwaffe doctors were already backing a different process. Quote, it was thought by the chief of the Luftwaffe Medical Service to be too bulky and expensive, unquote, Schroeder explained. Skipping down, the effectiveness of both the Schaefer process and the Burka, capital B-E-R-K-A method, would be tested on the Untermenschen at Dachau. A Luftwaffe physician named Hermann Becker Freising, or Freising, capital F-R-E-Y-S-E-N-G, was assigned to assist Dr. Schaefer and to co-author with him a paper documenting the results of the contest. The senior doctor advising Becker Freising and Schaefer in their work was Dr. Siegfried Ruff, capital R-U-F-F. The resultant paper called Thirst and Thirst Quenching in Emergency Situations at Sea, unquote, described saltwater medical experiments conducted on prisoners inside experimental cell block 5 at Dachau. These experiments were in the context of finding ways to make seawater posable for Luftwaffe pilots who had been shot down, mainly over the English Channel during the Battle of Britain, but over other bodies of water as well. More about these five doctors from the Dachau medical experiments who had already signed contracts with the U.S. Operation Paperclip, once again by Amy Jacobson. Unlike Dr. Alexander, Colonel Lovelace was able to interview Hubertus Strughold and Ruth's colleague, Dr. Theodore Benziger, B-E-N-Z-I-N-G-E-R, the high-altitude specialist who ran the Reich's experimental station of the Air Force Research Center, Rechlin, R-E-C-H-L-I-N, located north of Berlin. This was the same Dr. Benziger who had overseen for Himmler the film Screaming at the Reich Air Ministry in Berlin of Dachau prisoners being murdered in medical experiments. And still more from Operation Paperclip. With high praise from RAF and Army Air Force doctors, with high praise from Royal Air Force and Army Air Force officers, Doctors Ruff, Benziger, and Schaefer were now each being considered for leading positions at the new research lab. And presumably Leon Jaworski once again exercised judicial restraint by way of underscoring the degree of continuity. And again, do note that five of the doctors involved in the gruesome Dachau medical experiments have already signed contracts to work for the U.S. To give an idea of the continuity between the Third Reich's military medical complex and the post World War II genesis of our own, reading once again from Operation Paperclip. The U.S. Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg was a squat, brick, two-story facility facing the Neckar Rivers, M-E-C-K-A-R. Only a few months prior, it had been the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Medical Research, a bastion of Nazi science where chemists and physicists worked on projects for the Reich's war machine. At its front office, the Reich's flag came down and the U.S. flag went up. Photographs of Hitler were pulled from the walls and replaced by framed photographs of Army Air Force's generals in military pose. Most of the furniture stayed the same. In the dining room, German waiters in white service coats provided table service at mealtimes. A single 5-inch by 8-inch requisition receipt dated September 14th, 1945, made the transition official. Quote, "This property is needed by U.S. forces, and the requisition is in proportion to the resources of the country," unquote. The mission statement of the project, classified top secret, was succinct. Quote, "The exploitation of certain uncompleted German aviation medical projects," unquote. Dr. Hubertus Strughold, who was the top researcher in the Dachau projects, was put in charge of hiring doctors, quote, "all of whom are considered authorities in a particular field of medicine." And again, the mission statement of this was formerly the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Medical Research, And then it became the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Research Center. This in Heidelberg, Germany. This property is needed by U.S. forces, and the requisition is in proportion to the resources of the country. The mission statement of the project, classified top secret, was succinct. The exploitation of certain uncompleted German aviation medical research projects. Dr. Hubertus Strughold, who was the top researcher in the Dachau projects, was put in charge of hiring doctors, quote, all of whom are considered authorities in a particular field of medicine. Very quickly, in For the Record 316 and in other programs dealing with Ed Haslam's brilliant research, first accessed in the book Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and then in the supplemented volume Dr. Mary's Monkey, found a profound biological warfare connection to the JFK assassination. And among those reading now from the earlier volume, this from For the Record 316, was Jose Rivera, ND and PhD. Quote, "There were other connections between the National Institutes of Health and New Orleans. Of particular interest was Jose Rivera, MD, PhD, who sat on the NIH Board of Directors in the 1960s. We will note that Dr. Rivera was really Colonel Jose A. Rivera, one of the U.S. Army's top experts in biological warfare, and that in the summer of 1963, he was in New Orleans, handing out research grants from NIH, the Institute for Neurological Diseases and Blindness, to Tulane Medical School, LSU Medical School, and the Ochsner Clinic. In other discussions, in some of our on-air discussions with Ed Haslam, Dr. Rivera, or Colonel Jose Rivera, was on the staff of Douglas MacArthur, as we have seen. The Unit 731 Japanese Biological Warfare Research Center under Dr. Shiro Ishii was also incorporated into Fort Beecher at the end of World War II. Now, some more concerning some of these Third Reich alumni, again, at the genesis of the U.S. military medical complex. From For the Record 480, we excerpt at Lab 257, "The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Plum Island Germ Laboratory" by Michael Christopher Carroll. And in that, we dealt with another project paperclip in import, Dr. Eric Traub, who was specifically involved with researching animal diseases and who reported directly to Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler. By the way, as did another doctor whom we looked at in connection with our discussion of AIDS, Dr. Kurt Blohm. He was a general and was the deputy surgeon general of the Third Reich, and he also reported directly to Heinrich Himmler. We looked at Blohm in AFA 39 and also in For the Record programs 912 and 1012 as well. Of Dr. Eric Traub, he eventually became a formidable presence at Plum Island doing research into animal diseases, and he worked with the aforementioned Dr. Kurt Blohm on experiments. Reading now from Lab 257, "One of the participating interested agencies," unquote, "was the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which admittedly set up large plots of land throughout the Midwest for airborne anti-crop germ spray tests. Fort Beecher's Special Operations Division ran vulnerability tests," unquote, "in which operatives walked around Washington, D.C. and San Francisco with suitcases holding Serratia marcescens, a bacteria recommended to Fort Beecher by Traub's nominal supervisor, Nazi germ czar and Nuremberg defendant, Dr. Kurt Blohm. Tiny perforations allowed the germs release so they could trace the flow of the germs through airports and bus terminals. Shortly thereafter, 11 elderly men and women checked into hospitals with never-before-seen Serratia marcescens infections. One patient died. Decades later, when the germ tests were disclosed, the Army denied responsibility. Note here that in these tests, and by the way, there was also a barge towed around San Francisco Bay that dispensed Sorafim Arcesans into the atmosphere. The Bay Area remains one of the epicenters of Sorafim Arcesans infections. It primarily it is not particularly serious for younger people, but tends to kill older people, not altogether unlike many of the less virulent strains of COVID-19. The point being here that we are looking at Dr. Eric Traub and Dr. Kurt Blome enlisting elements of the U.S. military to perform experiments on the American population. Both Eric Traub and Kurt Blome reported directly to Reichsfuhrer SS. Question, what is wrong with this picture? Answer, everything. And as people know, bureaucracies tend to be creatures of inertia. And this concludes For the Record program number 1123. The past is prologue, further rumination on COVID-19 and the genesis of the military medical complex. This is being recorded live on March 20th of 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.